Les colloques du Collège de France.
So our second speaker of this afternoon is Yang Zheng, who is an assistant professor of cultural anthropology in the Department of Applied Social Sciences at the Hong Kong Polytechnic University. Her work deals with the urban development and migration in China, and she focuses on development, temporality, and mobility, examining issues related to the state formation, labor, infrastructures, and informal economy in the context of urban China. And Beijing, for instance, among other towns, which is enlarging now the spectrum. She's also interested in issues related to development and energy, such as China wind power projects and their global impact. Zhang is the winner of 2020 Vermeer Prize for the best article, and now she's currently working on a book manuscript tentatively titled Brutal Temporary, Venture Immigrants on the Politics of Futures on China's Urban Fringe. She's now talking, as you can see there, about internal borders and racialized strangers, the case of Chinese rural migrant workers. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sylvia, for the introduction, and thank you, Didier, for having me here, and thank you all, the audience, for being here and joining us today. I feel very honored and privileged to be here to share some of my observations during my fieldwork in Chinese metropolitan cities, such as Beijing and Shenzhen for the past 10 to 12 years. And I would like to start today's talk with this picture. In this picture, you can see there is a window, a mattress, and a half-demolished wall. I took this picture in 2019 when a migrant community in China, where I spent years doing fieldwork, was under demolition. The space shown in the picture was once home to my friend, Qi Jun. Qi Jun was a migrant worker coming from rural China. More specifically, Qi Jun was a scrap picker. I got to know him in 2013. Many times I sat with him actually in front of this wall and asking him about all the stories that he had experienced, and I had so many questions. Usually, he cut me off, and almost every time he would respond with a standard reply, "We are from different worlds, so you wouldn't understand." And sometimes it feels very strange, because even if I repeat what he just told me, he would still say, "You don't understand. It's not the case." So on that day, when I took that picture, I still tried to show that I understand what he had gone through. So I said, "I cannot imagine what you're going through, losing a place to live, had to move again." And he smiled at me and said, "This is actually very much anticipated. I'm so used to it. It's no big deal." So that's the moment that I had with Qi Jun. The existential differences mentioned by Qi Jun can refer to many different things, but the main difference in his mind was this piece of document. This is called household registration. As you can see in the picture, household registration is a sort of a document for Chinese citizens. And in this document, household registration, there are a lot of information of a person, a place of origin, place of birth, date of birth, and most importantly, as you can see, the red stem on the top, that says rural household registration. So there are two kinds of households in China: rural household registration and urban household registration. So China has this very unique household registration system, which differentiates the population into the urban ones and the rural ones. And this system was implemented in 1958, 9 years after the establishment of People's Republic of China. It was a means of controlling population's movement. It is commonly understood that household registration system corresponds to its socialist planned economy, where industries and people were largely fixed spatially. And when China inserted itself into the global economy in the 1980s, these internal borders set up by household registration system was often considered as obstacles or barriers. But ironically, this institutionalized urban-rural divide in China did not prevent people from moving from rural parts to the urban cities. So you can see this is a map which shows the pattern of internal migration in China. So this map is actually a little bit dated, but the pattern remains the same. The green color indicates outflow of migrants, and the red color indicates the inflow of migrants. So since the 1980s, the number of rural migrants in China has kept growing. According to a statistical report, the number of rural Chinese migrants working away from home is now almost 290 million. So that's a huge number. So Qi Jun, being one of those 290 million rural migrant people, once said to me, when you venture out, there is always a price to pay. His comments point out the fact that contrary to common perception, internal borders are not kept to prevent border crossing, but to ensure that when people cross borders, they become identifiable, questionable, and therefore kept at the margin. So according to my fieldwork experience, I think there are two significant effects of these internal borders. First, there is a spatial separation of income and rights for Chinese rural migrants. When rural residents migrate to cities in search of cash income and so-called the better future, they are included in the production system with their labor, but they are excluded from the urban social welfare system. This means that entitlements such as health benefits, education, basic income, and housing remains, those benefits remains in the villages of their birthplace and cannot be easily transferred to the cities. So many rural migrants live in very crowded factory dormitories, and they have to separate from their families, their children, and once a year, probably during Spring Festival, they would travel back to their village to visit their relatives. And there are many other migrant workers who move their entire family to cities and live in cramped conditions on the urban fringes. So here is a typical migrant community in China. You can see the high-rise buildings are the urban space, and the in the middle, all these very kind of informal housing, which were built by villagers themselves, they were there to host rural migrants in China. So in China, there is this term, it's called floating population. This term has been coined to reflect that rural migrants face a dilemma. They are not able to settle in the cities where they were treated as temporary visitors. But at the same time, they cannot go back because there are very limited job opportunities back in their hometowns. So this spatial separation of production and social reproduction, or income and rights, is key to make the so-called cheap labor in China for the past three decades. And second, the institutional barriers, such as rural household registration, is used to select the deserving talents to be incorporated as the urban members. So apart from keeping rural migrants included in the urban world with their labor, these internal borders are there, so the government can select those who are considered favorable in the process of so-called industrial upgrading in China. So for example, right now, there are many Chinese cities started to recruit more talents. And rural migrants with higher education degrees, sometimes they were able to be granted urban household registrations through a credit system. However, it is more common, for example, in the city of Shenzhen, where this is a center of the world factory in China, it is very rare to see rural migrants get incorporated into the talent system. More often than not, they are still considered as undeserving migrants who usually to be displaced whenever there are new projects that are taking over their communities. So even though China's household registration remains in place until today, on the ground, the control and the policing over Chinese internal borders have undergone several phases, which I'm going to be elaborating. So when rural to urban migration began to proliferate in China in the late 1990s, the internal border of rural and urban world were very much embodied. This means those migrants who left their place of origin were treated as transgressors in the cities, and it's very common for them to be criminalized. And at that time, there was this system called the custody and the repatriation system, which was in place to actualize population control on the ground. It was very common for the police to physically detain rural personnel and repatriate them back to their registered addresses. In a statistical report back in the 1995, a custody and repatriation station in China has taken 100,382 migrants into custody over the course of 3 years, from 1992 to 1995, among whom 91,849 were said to have broken the law. But along, you know, when you look into the document, it is usually the case that, for example, 260 were taken into custody for street vending, and 37 or unregistered drivers, and in 12,110 cases, migrants were taken into custody simply because they had, quote, illegally out-migrated, unquote. So back in the days, it was very common to see this criminalization of rural migrants, and many of them under the custody and repatriation system. They were usually kept in the station for several days and then picked up by their relatives and going back home. But during this period of time, even though there were discrimination, there were criminalization, migrant business were actually valued in China, because that was the early days of China's market reform. And precisely because rural migrants were not affiliated with urban formal institutions, they become the pioneer in the market in Denver during the open and reform period in China. So I'm going to show you this picture here. So you can see this is the what we call the, this is also a migrant community in Beijing. And rural migrants there, they were specialized and very successful in doing garment business. And a community member once told a journalist that in this community, there were over 36,000 businesses in the community. The revenue was over 30 billion yuan. And so it this place, this migrant community, had taken over 50% of the garment retail business in Beijing. So at that time, during the 1990s to the early 2000s, even though rural migrants experienced multiple eviction campaigns, they would often leave the community briefly, only to return to continue their business when the campaign ended. However, a new phase started in 2003. This 2003 actually marked a new era. An era began with a young man's death. You can see in this picture, this man, his name is Sun Zhigang. He was a college graduate from Wuhan. On March the 17th, 2003, 20 days after he arrived in Guangzhou, Sun Zhigang went outside to surf the internet, as he often did. But he was stopped by a police officer, as Sun Zhigang had not applied for temporary residential permits and carried no identification at that moment. He was taken into custody. The next day, he was transferred to the nearby custody and repatriation station. Sun Zhigang never made it out of the station alive. The public was enraged. It was suspected that Sun Zhigang was mistaken for a rural migrant and therefore became a victim of violence. So at that time, hundreds of scholars signed petitions. So 3 months later, after Sun Zhigang's death, the custody and repatriation system that had existed in China for over 40 years came to an end. As you can see in the picture, this was the time when these offices were removed in China. And during that period of time, rural migrants were known no longer as no longer criminalized as the strangers in the city, but they were usually considered as the so-called vulnerable groups who deserve help and service. So the discourse has changed at the beginning of 2000, and many non-governmental organizations entered these migrant communities to set up service centers. Ironically, even though in discourse and in a lot of public actions, rural migrants were more accepted into the urban world. However, the life for urban migrants in Chinese cities had become more and more difficult for a different reason. Because around this period of time, where the state control over migrants were more or less eliminated, the fact that at that time, in metropolitan cities such as Beijing, where I did my field work, the real estate projects were rapidly proliferating. And In the same year, 2003, the total investment in real estate in Beijing was about 19 billion. But by 2007, just 4 years after that, the investment grew by 10 times, reaching 200 billion. So you can see this fast development of real estate became the pillar of the urban economy in China. And also, in addition to that, in the city of Beijing, was preparing for the Olympics in 2008. So land became very key resources. So the community of rural migrants, they occupy the land on the outskirts of Beijing, and those lands become more and more valuable. So their place, their community become the target of demolition. So the living space for rural migrants were further squeezed, and migrants were constantly displaced as rural-urban border shifted. And at that time, of course, compared to real estate projects, migrant businesses such as the garment business were no longer appreciated by the local government. So usually, migrants started to live in very in informal buildings that were very cramped. And you can see this is the picture of the so-called handshake buildings, meaning the buildings are constructed very closely to each other. And this is the typical migrant children's school in Beijing, because migrants, they cannot send their children to the public school, so they have their own migrant children's school on the outskirts of Beijing. So during this period of time, I would say it is usually you see the pattern of neglect from the state, because usually people would think the land that occupied by rural migrants will sooner or later be developed into commercial buildings. So it's a matter of time. There is no need to continue to sort of discipline this population anymore. So that was about 10 years period of time. And then the third phase came in the mid-2010s. At that time, the city government of Beijing reinforced a much stricter control over rural migrants. And at this time, the control was not directly targeting rural migrants, but rather their informal business. For example, in 2014, the Beijing government started to, quote, adjust and evacuate the non-capital function of the city, unquote. And in 2015, the municipal government took down Beijing's largest and most successful zoo wholesale market, evicting over 100,000 rural migrants. And many of these migrants had been running small businesses operated on the urban fringe for many, many years. And then the most extreme case happened in 2017. On November 2017, a fire broke out in the migrant community, killing 19 rural migrants. And 2 days after the fire, the city government of Beijing, deploying police and other security forces, initiated a citywide campaign to evict rural migrants from cheap rental apartments all over the metropolitan area, citing safety concerns. And tens of thousands of migrants were given extremely short notice and forced out of their apartments into freezing cold. Many of them had just a few days to leave and even became temporarily homeless. So here I'm showing some of the picture of the 2017 mass eviction campaign in Beijing. Some more pictures. You can see some of the buildings were tearing down, and many of the people were moving out. So the sudden eviction campaign really enraged, again, many middle-class people, many urbanites in Beijing, and many of them demonstrated their willingness to stand with rural migrants. They changed their social media profile, name to low-end population, a derogatory term that appeared in public media in reference to rural migrants to justify the evictions. So this is the briefly, you know, how things has changed over the years, and there are so many ironies and so many kind of layered developments regarding rural migrants in China. So I have to confess that I worry every time I heard about demolition and evictions that drive migrants away. But what most disturbs me, however, is not the individual moments of displacement, but the normalization of displacement. Displacement itself is usually eventful, but being displaceable is a constant state. Many of the rural migrants I came to know, they live in this constant state, living in this constant state of hyper-uncertainty, and they have to face constant interruptions in life. So the next question is, how rural migrants cope with the population control, and how do they exist in the condition of hyper-uncertainty and constant interruption? How do they exist in this situation where tomorrow cannot be planned, where it is very hard to plan a stable life for themselves and for their family members? It turns out very few rural migrants I have encountered in China, China's metropolitan cities, have planned to settle down in cities where they work. Many of them actually plan to purchase urban houses in other smaller townships or cities after they accumulated enough money. They would put the money as a down payment and to sort of a secure urban house elsewhere. So for these migrants, everything is so temporal. Everything becomes quite, well, the future becomes quite unpredictable. They are very much aware that they live on borrowed time, and such anticipation increase their sense of urgency when they stay in the cities, because they know their stay in the urban communities is timed. So they become very much conscious of that period of time when they stay there. And they know they must get into the business and try to accumulate as much as they could before it is too late. Therefore, it is not uncommon to see many of these migrants, they put long-term consideration aside and very much focus on their informal businesses for short-term returns. And also, at the same time, the anticipation of a sudden eviction or sudden displacement also generate, ironically, a sense of acceptance among migrants. The logic is that because they think their stay in the city, their stay in the cities is temporary. So all the troubles and problems and suffering that are associated with this period of stay is also temporary. So many people convince themselves to accept reality as it is. So it is very common to see people use a lot of energy to convince themselves. There is this exercise of what I call epistemic labor of acceptance. For example, Qi Jun once told me, you need to know when to ignore the things that you cannot change. And also he was convinced that he needed to, quote, differentiate what can be fixed and what cannot be fixed. So he could, quote, focus on the reality. So this is not a unique case. Actually, many migrants try to remind themselves every day to accept their situation as is. This actually requires constant self-persuasion, storytelling, and a collective discussion among themselves. So for me, temporality is critical to understand the mode of living of Chinese migrants in the metropolitan area. And for the similar reason, rural migrants also think the discrimination and the othering that they experience can be also temporal. And this is also something that struck me, because in everyday life, it is very common for urbanites to point out who are the rural migrants, because they can look a little bit different, because they are the manual laborers who work under the sun, so their skin colors can be darker, and they have different kind of style of dressing code. And of course, they also speak dialects. So I would say we can observe this othering process and the essentialization of rural migrants in metropolitan China. But however, at the same time, the rural-urban difference in China are not understood on racial terms in the Chinese context. Rather, rural-urban differences are often explained by economic disparity and are perceived to be something to be fixed in the course of so-called development. As a result, even though rural migrants are often stuck in very difficult situations, they still think being in these migrant community and to continue to work, for example, as informal laborers, is the only way to get ahead. So what I observed is that when othering process is perceived as temporal, it is very difficult for people to act upon the situation. There seems to be a perpetuated effort among the Chinese rural migrants to become someone else. They constantly feel that they are all out of place when they stay in the city, and they look forward for a future. And to achieve that future, they have to suspend their life, their present life. So this is the kind of mode of living that I have observed as an anthropologist in the Chinese migrant community. So at last, I would like to go back to this picture which I showed at the beginning of my talk. So I often think about my interaction with Qi Jun on that day. Because Qi Jun always, sometimes he teases me, but sometimes he always deny that I can fully understand him and his logic and his story. Many years after I have become friends with him, I realize the fact that he deny, or he claim his epistemic priority in understanding his world is actually quite admirable. Behind that act to sort of reject me, to refuse my effort to understand him, I think behind that there is a desire to tell his own story. There is a desire to acquire equality, and also there is this desire to be recognized. There is this desire to have their differences recognized and valued. So I would like to end my talk with Qi Jun's old apartment, and I truly hope that in the future, many of the migrants that I had got to know for the past few years, they are able to develop or to achieve a future that they had desired for so many years. Thank you all for listening.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.